Hello, everyone. I am Catherine Spires, and this is Smart Mouth, your hopefully favorite food history podcast. Before we get to today's episode, I'll tell you about Smart Mouth social media. There is a Facebook group. You can search the Facebook search bar for Smart Mouth, which is two words, and choose the group, not the page, and I'll add you to it just as soon as I can. We're also on Instagram at Smart Mouth Podcast. And we're also on Patreon. I'd love to get your support as I set up the Smart Mouth e-newsletter, which should debut before the end of the year. It will. I'm going to do it. I'm saying it publicly, so it will. thank you to the most recent patron, Chloe Chiasson. I'm so sorry that I mispronounced it at least one time. Chloe, thank you so much for contributing. I think I know who you are on Twitter. You've been a doll. Thank you. If anyone else wants to go check out the donor levels, you can find it at patreon.com/smartmouthpodcast. This week's replay guest is Brooke Williamson. She is a Southern California chef and restaurateur, and she's a two-time Top Chef contestant, and she won it her second time. In this episode, we talked about peanut butter cups, which is a surprisingly wide-ranging topic. And we also got into the issue of cooking with gloves on, which is a topic that was actually recently discussed in the Smart Mouth Facebook group. It's kind of more of a health hazard than you might think, than some politicians would have you believe. It's interesting. I also wanted to mention that I realized that I've had a bunch of Top Chef contestants on Smart Mouth: Sheldon Simeon, Shirley Chung, Claudette Zepeda-Wilkins, John Tizar, Casey Thompson, Naisha Arrington, and also Top Chef judge Gail Simmons. So you can go back and search for those if you want more Top Chef content, which I always do. So maybe you will too. If you enjoy Smart Mouth, please tell a friend. It's a great way to build up the listenership. Thanks, everybody. On to the show. Welcome back to Smart Mouth. I am your host, Catherine Spires. Thanks to everyone who has rated, reviewed, and subscribed on iTunes. User Too Many Goats gave Smart Mouth our most recent 5-star review, so thank you so much. This week's guest on Smart Mouth is a star on Top Chef. She's the co-owner of some restaurants in California, including Da Kiko Kiko and The Triple and some other places, and she is a lover of peanut butter cups. Brooke Williamson. Hi, Brooke.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm good.
Thanks so much for coming on the show today.
My pleasure.
We are sitting outside, which is the beauty of Southern California.
It's nice out here.
Yeah, it's a beautiful day out. We're literally like adjacent to some wetlands, and there's some palm trees and the ocean. And
This is my little office.
It's a nice office to have. Because you're in Los Angeles County. This is still the county.
This is still Los Angeles County. I mean, it's not quite considered South Bay yet. Mm-hmm. Playa del Rey is kind of that weird, sleepy beach town on the outskirts of Los Angeles. Yeah.
Yeah. And it definitely has that vibe. Like, there's a lot of, like, low-slung construction. And I'm seeing surfboards and bicycles everywhere.
Yep. That's my life right now. It's great.
It's great. It is great. Have you worked in, like, more intense cities?
I mean, I've pretty much only worked in Los Angeles and like a brief stint of staging in New York. But for the most part, my entire restaurant experience is Los Angeles proper. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But like there's other parts of LA that are like a little more fast paced.
Yeah. I worked in West Hollywood. Very different atmosphere. I always thought I would live on the east side. I always loved the east side of Los Angeles until I moved to Venice, and then I fell in love with the west side, and I swore I would never move east again. So it's one or the other, right?
Yeah, and it's a good spot, and like if you just take a stroll up and down the main drag, you see more than one of your restaurants.
Yeah, so we have right here in Playa del Rey, we're behind the Triple right now. Actually, we're sitting right outside Triplicate, which is the store that we opened about a year and a half ago. We're actually in the process of relocating it right now to Playa Vista. Mm-hmm. But yeah, right up front, we have the Triple, which is kind of banging for Sunday lunch business right now.
Yeah.
And then down the street, we have Playa Provisions, of course, which is right at the beach.
Yeah, which is such a cool location.
Thank you.
Just straggle in from the beach.
It is, yeah.
Have a cocktail.
Yeah, we're crazy for brunch today because the sun is finally out this week.
It's been a while.
Yes.
I noticed in a lot of your previous interviews that the one like sugary, desserty thing that like you sometimes talk about is peanut butter cups.
Yeah, they're kind of my go-to when I have a sweet tooth.
And you're kind of specific about them. You're kind of fancy about your peanut
I
butter
am.
Cups.
I actually, you know, I don't take my sweets lightly because I try not to overindulge too much. I travel a lot, and when I'm home, I try to eat really healthy. I'm actually in the middle of doing the Whole 30 right now, which is like a elimination diet. So there's no dairy, no sugar, no alcohol, no soy, no grains. It's kind of an intense diet, and I'm really missing peanut butter cups.
I know. Are you super cranky right now?
No, actually, I'm past the point of cranky.
Okay.
Not in like a bad way, but in an adjusted way.
Okay.
I'm actually feeling really good. So it just kind of goes to show you what food can do to your state of mind. I'm very picky when it comes to my sweets because I try not to eat them too much. And I don't like milk chocolate, and 99% of the peanut butter cups that you find in the store is milk chocolate. So, I gravitate toward two specific types of peanut butter cups.
Okay.
One is Justin's, the dark chocolate peanut butter. I eat the Justin's peanut or almond butter and peanut or the nut butters in general.
Uh-huh.
I do love the texture of that peanut butter. I also love the Trader Joe's, the mini dark chocolate peanut butter cups.
Got it.
And those are something that's a staple that you'll always find in my kitchen.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very cool. It's interesting that you mentioned like health and peanut butter cups because their status has kind of gone up and down according to what Americans consider healthy at any given time. In the early 1900s, back in the days when a calorie was a calorie, people were like, oh, this is like nutritious too. So eat these to get like a whole nutrition kind of thing. And then when in the 80s, when people were afraid of fat, peanut butter cups lost the market.
Right.
And I feel like they must be going up right now because people are into fat again.
You know, I think people are into fat again. And I think that people are definitely not scared of nut fat. Sorry.
That's an upsetting turn of phrase.
But I also think that peanut butter as a whole is on the decline because I think that people have realized that peanuts in general are not wonderful for you compared to other nuts like almonds.
Okay.
So I think that, you know, I have tried to kind of eliminate as much peanut butter from my life and replace it with other nuts like cashew butter and almond butter because I know that nutrition per calorie for peanut butter is not fantastic.
Interesting.
There's a lot of protein in peanuts, but I think that is pretty much what you get out of peanuts is protein rather than other nutrients.
And I wonder if that's because, like, nutrition difference, peanuts, of course, are not tree nuts. They're legumes.
They're legumes, yeah.
So maybe that's what it is?
I mean, it's interesting. Part of this whole 30 diet is I can't eat legumes, and because of that, I can't eat peanuts.
Oh, no.
And I totally miss peanut butter, but I miss it because it's an indulgence of mine, not because it's a, you know, nutritional staple in my diet.
Right. Okay. That makes sense. Well, now let's go on and talk about this thing that you miss and you can't have.
Thanks.
So Georgia and Texas are the biggest peanut producing states in the US, but the U.S. isn't the biggest peanut producer in the world. China and India.
I was going to say Asia.
Yeah. Yeah. There's so much more into it. Like, peanuts in India and China are blowing up.
Right. That makes sense. I mean, you look at like Thai food and Chinese food, and there's a lot of peanut in those.
Absolutely.
In this sort of overall. Yeah. I mean, when I think of Thai food, I think of like pad thai.
Yeah.
Which is covered in peanuts.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Of course, Jimmy Carter was famously a peanut farmer before he became president.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I feel like I should have known that. But
it's sort of one of those things that makes him like America's cutest president.
Right? That's interesting trivia.
Yeah. Yeah. In America, the difference is more than half of our peanut crop goes into making peanut butter, which makes sense when you learn that it takes 540 peanuts to make a 12-ounce jar of peanut butter.
Wow.
That's a lot.
Wow. Yeah, that is a lot. I wonder if, I mean, it must be done, but I mean, not by hand mostly, right?
I think not.
The shucking of actual peanuts.
Yeah. And it was around 1900 that someone actually made the machinery to mechanize all of that. Before that, peanuts were considered kind of a trash food for various reasons. But one of the reasons is that when you hand open all the peanut shells, you're leaving scraps in there. So anytime you bought like a bag of peanuts, there would be like branches and whatnot stuck in there. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, having just spent some time in the South, there were, you know, you would see boiled peanuts all over the side of the street being sold. And that was not something that I was familiar with at all.
Right. Right. I don't know about it either, being entirely West Coast myself.
And I tried them, and it was interesting. It was not the texture that I'm used to having a peanut.
They're soft.
Like soft. Yeah. But really interesting. It's a whole different snack.
Did you enjoy it?
I didn't not enjoy it.
Okay.
It's not something that I would kind of run back to or necessarily do myself.
Yeah.
But it was more sort of educational and interesting to me than it was anything else.
Yeah. Well, I learned that in the early marketing for Reese's Peanut Butter Cups, one of the things they talked about to differentiate themselves was that they had actually roasted the peanuts. Mm-hmm. And that for a lot of people, for instance, after the Civil War, circuses started offering roasted peanuts as snacks and at baseball games. And that was one of the things that led people to actually like peanuts also, because the roasted flavor is so much more interesting, perhaps, to a lot of people than the boiled flavor.
Yeah, and I feel like most peanut butter today is dry roasted.
Mm-hmm. Or at least they say that.
Right.
But then I feel like they add so many other
oils.
That it doesn't even matter necessarily.
How they're roasted.
Yeah, there's a lot of other junk in a lot of commercial peanut butter.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I try to, when I go for peanut butter, I try to get the like fresh ground peanut butter straight out of the machine, partially because it occupies my son at the supermarket. He loves to press the button. But
that's adorable.
Also, because I prefer the texture and the taste of it, like coming straight out of the machine. I know all the ingredients that are in it. However, for baking purposes and cooking purposes, I generally gravitate toward the processed peanut butter because it gives you a completely different texture when adding to, say, cookies. I mean, if I'm making cookies at home, I'll make it with fresh almond butter, like ground almond butter.
Okay.
Peanut butter cookies at the restaurant. Mm-hmm. I mean, I dare say they're actually made with processed peanut butter because it gives you that like sort of beautiful, chewy, wonderful peanut butter texture that you can't get with fresh peanut butter.
Is that because you have the uniformity? You know what you're going to work with and it's going to be the same?
Not only
time?
That, but I think that there are binders in processed peanut butter that come in handy when baking.
Okay.
And they don't separate. The oils don't separate from the nuts. So it kind of makes for a perfect product when baking.
Yeah. No, I like stuff like that because certain different types of ingredients work better for different purposes.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's a good tip
to place,
know.
Yes.
Yeah. We can't all be hippies all the damn time.
Not all the time.
So I had thought that peanuts had originated in Africa, but it turns out I wasn't looking back far enough in history. They're from South America.
Oh.
Yeah, and the reason that archaeologists know this is because pottery in the shape of peanuts was made in Central and South American art like 3,500 years ago.
Fascinating.
Yeah, and they were like used to decorate other objects like
and
vases.
That's how that was discovered.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just like all these old things that look like peanuts.
Wow.
And then they also found out that specifically in Brazil, probably in other places too, but that a drink was made by smashing up peanuts and corn and turned into a drink.
Does this drink exist anywhere now?
That I'm not sure of.
Do you know what it was called?
I don't. Isn't that terrible? I know.
I might have to do some research on that.
Awesome. And then let us know what you find out.
Okay.
Because you know people are going to want to know about it.
Hmm.
So then Europeans came and discovered peanuts specifically in Mexico. And then they went back to Europe and traders started sending them over to Asia and into Africa. it hadn't come into North America yet, but then when Africans were brought over here as slaves, among the food items that they brought were the peanuts, which had become part of African, West African food culture at that point.
Right.
So that's how it came back to what was now the United States, but it wasn't grown commercially for about another 100, 150 years after it was first brought here.
Mm-hmm.
So at least not, you know, large scale commercially.
Right.
So that's how it got here. It was grown largely in Virginia, and it was used for oil and as a substitute for cocoa, which kind of makes weird sense
for
retroactively.
Cocoa. Really?
In terms of people combining chocolate and peanut butter.
Sure, but
similar flavor.
As for any other reason?
No, not really.
Okay.
And they were considered mostly livestock feed. Because the tops of them, the greens, again, they grow underground because they're not tree nuts. The greens were used to feed livestock.
Okay.
So that was like their main uses were commodity, essentially, not for their delicious flavor.
So who started grinding them and turning them into peanut butter?
Well, it still took a while. Because like I mentioned, the peanuts at the circuses and the baseball games, so those were still whole peanuts. And then during the Civil War, peanuts were like, oh, we can feed a bunch of soldiers with these, not just on the Confederate side, but on the Union side as well. So that's when peanuts started moving north in terms of people developing a taste for them. And around there is probably when people started really focusing on smashing them up and making them into a paste.
Hmm.
And at first it was called a paste.
A paste. Peanut paste.
Peanut paste.
Okay.
Which I'm still unsure on, like, when you're naming foods, what sounds gross and what doesn't.
Right. I mean, I don't, who decides that butter sounds better than paste?
Because butter
paste is not a great sounding food, but who decided that?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And
only because I correlate paste with like glue and toothpaste.
Yeah, not necessarily delicious items. Yeah. When you say peanut butter, it's okay, but when you say nut butter, that's gross.
That's true.
Just like on a lot of
but
levels.
But cocoa butter isn't gross. That doesn't sound, that sounds delicious.
That
to
does
me.
Sound delicious. That is. But cocoa butter, okay. You put it on yourself.
Yeah.
There's lots of different uses for cocoa butter.
True.
You could slather peanut butter on yourself. This is America. You can do what you want.
I mean, I suppose you could do anything.
Yeah. You really could. I mean, be careful, but. Yeah. So people, I mean, if you think about it, throughout all of history, people had technically been smashing it up, like in South America, making it into like a drink. There was smashing involved.
Right.
We talk about food smashing a lot on this show.
Really?
It ends up. There's various things that have to be smashed to achieve maximum deliciousness.
Huh.
Cuban sandwiches are one. You really got to smash them down.
Smash.
It's a different kind of smash.
Yeah.
It's a meat smash.
Right.
But still a smash. There should be a museum of food smashes.
Meat smash, nut smash. Yeah. All the same, right?
Wow. Yeah. So much smashing. So a lot of people think that George Washington Carver invented peanut butter.
Mm-hmm.
He actually didn't. He was just a big proponent of using peanuts and other southern crops as ways to make money and like being creative about how they might appeal to people so that farmers can make money. Because a lot of the peanut industry's growth was in response to the collapse of the cotton industry in the South in the late 1800s when the boll weevils came and ruined, just decimated cotton.
Mm-hmm.
They're really hungry for cotton crops in particular, not other ones. So he was the one who popularized peanut butter. He also encouraged using sweet potatoes and soybeans in new and interesting ways to try and diversify.
Right. With inexpensive,
yes,
abundant crops of stuff
that
was there already.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
And he's a hero, but I just realized that after about 50 years, all of his teachings were thrown to the side when we like made everything a commodity crop.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was great at the time that he was like, look into soybeans, but then everyone looked into soybeans too much.
Right.
And now we don't grow any specialty crops in America. Oh,
we're just Americans.
Yeah. Bummer. Oh, well, he tried and it lasted for a while. So you had asked earlier when specifically peanut butter, when people were like grinding it up, it came around the same time in 1900 when they invented the machines to like break open the peanut shells.
Right.
They were also like, oh, let's do smashing machines for these nuts as well. And there were a couple different ways of doing it. One that became popular was like two really hot sheets of metal just that you just slam together with the nuts in between them.
With nothing added.
At first.
Okay.
Yeah. So it went from natural, just the peanuts, maybe some salt, but those aren't shelf stable.
Right.
Originally. So along with the industrialization of American food, one of them was adding partially hydrogenated oils
right.
to peanut butter to make it shelf stable mm-hmm. and rather less healthy
yes.
for us
yes.
as humans. It wouldn't have become as popular without it.
Because you wouldn't have found it in the supermarket yeah. sitting on the shelf. Yeah.
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 Absolutely.
I mean, I remember even as a kid having an earthquake kit. Growing up in Los Angeles, we always uh-huh. had an earthquake kit. And there was always a huge tub of peanut butter in the earthquake kit because it lasts forever.
Oh.
So all those stabilizers and preservatives really did their job.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, there was always peanut butter.
Did you swap it out? I recently learned that you're supposed to swap out your bottled water in your earthquake kits.
Sure. I mean, I think it's enough of an accomplishment that I even had an earthquake kit to begin with. And I think it was a school project.
Okay.
So swapping out for fresher and potentially edible stuff was not a priority.
Right.
No.
Just that you had it in the first yeah, place.
Exactly.
That's fair, I think. So John Harvey Kellogg of Kellogg's.
I feel like I know this.
Okay.
I feel like you're reminding me of something, but I'm not going to take over because
you can.
I don't know enough.
You totally can.
He patented peanut butter, no?
Let me see. Did he? I don't know. There's a good chance he did.
Okay.
Because he patented a lot of stuff. That's mm-hmm. why Kellogg's Corporation has so much money. They were on the business tip as well. But yeah, he got in on that. As these things happen, peanuts and peanut butter, which has started as poor people food, when mm-hmm. he started being like, oh, you know what? I should have this be one of my cures at the sanitarium. Now it's for rich people. So it kind of like transferred and like
right.
around in the early 1900s, if you would go to a fancy ladies tea party, one of the crustless sandwiches would in fact be peanut butter.
Interesting.
Sandwiches.
Yeah. Interesting.
So it had a brief moment.
And it had protein and mm-hmm. could be swapped out for a meat probably.
That was a big part of it because he was such a big vegetarian and mm-hmm. it was like a health substitute. It was also meant to be a high protein nutrient for people with bad teeth or no teeth, mm-hmm. which was more of a concern. Back then.
Than it is now.
Yeah,
yes.
Absolutely. Especially more of a concern among the upper classes. But then a different guy altogether introduced peanut butter at the St. Louis World's Fair of 1904, which gets so much credit for so many food inventions that it pisses me off and I feel like it must be fake. But maybe not. Maybe it really did do all these things and that peanut butter was one of them. It was just a whole bunch of American entrepreneurs bringing their food discoveries.
And not patenting it.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Discovering but not making money.
I wonder if you can patent peanut butter. You can patent the process of making it.
The process, right?
Yes. Yes. But then if you discover another process, you're good to go.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like that process was inevitable.
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a much more accessible way
yes.
of eating peanuts. Mm-hmm. Much quicker. Shelling peanuts is a chore.
But kind of fun.
Yeah, as long as you're not too hungry.
I don't know. It's some of my best baseball game memories are
really
are peanuts. Yeah.
Aww.
I mean, I remember going to baseball games as a kid with my dad and the big gigantic salty bag of peanuts was one of my highlights. That and the carnation chocolate frozen chocolate thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think I've maybe been to one baseball game in my life.
Oh.
So, I know.
Oh, yeah, we were big on Dodger games.
Oh, that's
yeah.
great.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it was literally for the food. But
have you been back to Dodger Stadium recently?
I haven't been to a game in probably a year or two.
Okay.
But, I mean,
for a while they were doing fancy hot dogs, and by fancy I mean just like a lot of toppings.
No, I mean I don't know. Last time I went, I got a Dodger dog.
Okay. The classic.
The classic Dodger dog, mm-hmm. and it came wrapped in foil, and there was like a little table of toppings that you could put on it, but
okay.
it didn't come with stuff. No.
Nothing too crazy.
No.
I think
boiled hot dogs and warmed buns. I mean, it's like the perfect squishy baseball food.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like we should talk about that.
I mean, we can talk about everything. Because I believe that we stole the garlic fries idea from the San Francisco Giants and that Dodgers have them now.
Really?
I think.
Yeah, they're
yeah.
definitely I think that's a Gordon Biersch thing.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they were started in San Francisco and they're like a huge deal
mm-hmm.
there. And a couple years ago, I noticed the Dodgers were like, us too.
Well, I mean, you smell those things like three aisles away and then you end up standing in line.
Yeah.
because they're amazing.
Yeah. Garlic is such a great trick that way. It solves the food for you.
I mean, here at the Triple, actually, we do garlic shoestring fries, and literally we sell one order in the next table or the next person. It's all communal tables here. So people end up like sharing them and then ordering three more orders. My son literally comes here after school half the time just to get a pail of fries because it's literally just chopped garlic with a little like olive oil and salt and pepper, and that's it. But it makes for a really delicious French fry.
Absolutely. That sounds so good. So as a chef, when you add a dish like that to the menu, are you just like, what are your motivations? Are you like, this is a thing that's good and like makes sense for the restaurant? Or are you like that plus... It'll trick a lot of people.
What, like French fries in general?
Things that are garlicky, like things that are pure comfort food that can like attract via the nose.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, we do burgers here at the Triple. We do lots of other stuff too, but we're kind of known for our burgers.
Okay.
And when people think burgers, they think fries. And so we had to have fries on the menu. My favorite fries to eat, as well as my son's and my husband, are shoestring fries, really skinny fries. But we felt like we had to make them sort of unique in some way. So, I mean, honestly, adding a little garlic doesn't necessarily make them unique, but it makes them craveable. And we're also a very beer focused place. We're a craft beer bar, and eating salty, savory, snack food like French fries makes you want to order another beer.
That's right.
So there is some strategy behind it. We do need those sort of go-to snack foods for people also who aren't necessarily coming here for a full meal.
Okay.
There are people who come here just to try new beers.
Ah.
So they're a good snack food.
Okay. Well, that's funny in a way related to the episode because nuts, bowls of nuts on bars are an old bar trick also.
Salt, and they're always salty.
Yeah. To get people
because
to order more drinks.
You want people to remain thirsty and order more drinks. That's kind of the goal for most bars in the world.
It makes
you can
a lot
keep
of sense.
People drinking, then then you're happy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, why are shoestring fries your family's favorite?
My immediate family, my parents, my sister, we're all kind of crispy, crunchy fry lovers.
Okay.
I could generally pass on fries unless they're like beautifully crispy. Give me a steak fry and I will push it. That is not worth it to me. I have no desire for steak fries. I also don't really love potatoes, like baked potatoes or just potatoes in general. Like I could pass on a potato unless it's a hash brown or a crispy French fry.
Okay.
There's something about that like greasy golden crispiness of a fry that turns it into a whole different thing.
How do you feel about McDonald's fries?
I like McDonald's fries.
Okay.
My kid loves McDonald's fries.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's the only thing I will like go to McDonald's for is the French fries.
I mean, they're so good.
So good. Yeah. I mean, I think the last time I was at McDonald's was at 4 a.m. with my friend in New York because we needed McDonald's French fries.
Yeah.
But that's a different story.
So peanut butter is very famously only beloved in the United States, and in fact like a lot of other cultures find it disgusting.
Really?
Yeah, like it's kind of an old trope, but I remember seeing it happening and when I did study abroad in Italy is that people would have their parents send them care packages full of peanut butter and they would show their new Italian friends and the Italians would be like, what the fuck is wrong
with
you?
I mean I feel like I've been to Italy and I've never seen a peanut butter product anywhere.
Yeah, exactly.
In that's interesting. I never really thought about that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm actually not a huge peanut butter lover. I could take it or leave it. Mm-hmm. In fact, and I didn't like grow up eating peanut butter sandwiches. I think like the texture was sort of too heavy and dry for me. I'm not as much into it. But sometimes people compare peanut butter with Vegemite in terms of if you're not from the culture, you won't understand it. Yeah. I find that deeply offensive because Vegemite is disgusting.
To you.
No, but aren't I right? Like, objectively?
But if you were European, you might be saying that about peanut butter.
I know. It's true. I find Vegemite so offensive.
You know, it's interesting. My husband was always a huge peanut butter lover, and I was kind of the same way of like kind of take it or leave it, unless it's in like enrobed in chocolate.
Right.
I don't really care a whole lot about it. Mm-hmm. I wasn't like a peanut butter and jelly lover as a kid. Maybe partially because my mom would always put too much peanut butter on the peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. Like,
gotta have those proportions right.
But I do love a peanut butter chocolate combo, or like we do peanut butter peanut butter cookies at Playa Provisions, mm-hmm. and in the center of the cookie is a layer of strawberry jelly. And so we call them peanut butter and jelly cookies. And for some reason, that brightness of the strawberry jelly really turns it into a whole different thing.
Yeah.
But what I mean, my husband literally could stand over a jar of peanut butter and eat the entire thing with a spoon. I was never like that. And again, I have my place for peanut butter. My son hates peanut butter and hates things that taste similar to peanut butter. He doesn't love sesame because sesame makes him feel like he's eating peanut butter.
Okay.
I used to cook with a lot of sesame oil, and I'm a kind of an Asian food lover, and so mm-hmm. is my son. He will eat anything covered in soy sauce, but put sesame oil in it, and he's kind of immediately turned off because he thinks there's peanut butter in it, which is interesting. Kind of hits the palate the same way.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That is interesting.
I think people either love it or hate it, and then there are a few in between like us who are kind of take it or leave it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, add chocolate or like strawberry jam to it and I'm fine.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. There is one other country that does get into peanut butter the same way the U.S. does, and that's Haiti. It's actually mm-hmm. a street snack, not just the peanuts, but actual like peanut butter. I guess it's called Mamba and it's super popular there. We were talking about like gross names earlier, and in the Netherlands, it's called pindakaas, which means peanut cheese.
Ew.
I like that immediate reaction. Now we know where you stand on that. Yeah.
It doesn't sound appetizing at all.
It's very strange. No. I guess it's because they have like a lot of soft spreadable cheese there. Mm. So it was the more obvious.
It's interesting because you find like vegan cheeses at like Whole Foods and stuff, like uh-huh. cashew cheese. Mm-hmm. And the moment that you put the word cheese behind cashew, I have no desire to purchase it.
1000% agreed. I went to a vegan restaurant here in LA where their particular point of pride was the cheeses because they make their vegan cheeses in-house. And they didn't taste like anything. And I felt really bad and decided not to write about it because they were so proud of them.
Hey, have you had, there's one like, it almost tastes like the consistency is of a soft ripened cheese and it's made from almond milk.
I don't think I've had an almond cheese.
I've had some really good almond cheese. It's like almond brie.
And
it doesn't really taste like almond. It kind of doesn't taste like a whole lot, but the texture of it is really wonderful.
Okay.
So...
That might be worth something. I really like cashews a lot, but apparently cashew cheese does nothing for me.
No, it kind of has that chalky texture. I'm not a big fan.
No. Yeah. I don't like substitutes.
Yeah.
I'm all for being vegan, but then you got to just eat your vegetables.
So immediately, because it's called cashew cheese, you're thinking it's a substitute. But what if it were called cashew butter or cashew spread or cashew... Yeah. Something else,
yeah.
And then you wouldn't necessarily think of it as a substitute. Uh-huh. It would be its own thing.
That's right. It's all about the marketing and the branding.
Yeah.
But they're marketing to vegans as well, and I feel like vegans often miss the cheese and are looking for a substitute.
Got it. Yeah. No, it's true. And generally, if you're ordering something with cashew cheese, it's as a substitute.
I guess that's true.
Because you don't want to eat dairy. So
yeah. Oh, so complicated. apparently peanut butter is becoming popular in Saudi Arabia because so many Americans move there to work and move their families there. And then like the kids come to school with their peanut butter sandwiches. Saudi Arabian kids learn about them. Yeah. Now it's popular there too. The spread of peanut butter.
Right. That apparently is American now.
Yeah. I mean, it's all part of colonialism, really. Mm-hmm. That's what we're learning doing this podcast, is mm-hmm. that everything is colonialist and most food is evil. And it's a real bummer. But I think it's important to know.
Right.
Right?
That we've adapted it as our own, but it actually didn't originate here.
Nothing originated here. Well, no. Some stuff did. But then usually
few things.
Food that originated here, we think, I tell you, Thomas Jefferson, don't even get me started. That guy didn't invent anything and he gets all the credit for it. It makes me so mad.
It's like Mr. Kellogg.
Yeah. Yeah. Old rich white dudes, right? Like, brace yourselves, didn't do a lot of their own cooking, right. Guys.
Shocker. Sorry,
I know. So, yeah. We're learning. So, getting to chocolate-covered peanut butter cups, mm-hmm. those were sold starting in 1907. Various small candy makers around the country, sometimes sold as, one piece in chocolate boxes, you know, when they have like all the different flavors.
Like a truffle.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And since they're high calorie, but like high natural calories. Well, in 1907, we weren't really doing like fake calories, but they were like a treat, but like a healthy treat, like not too bad, not too crazy.
Some added protein.
Mm-hmm, right. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, exactly. But it all, again, it had to be regional because it wasn't packaged for, to be shelf stable
right.
yet. So the rise in peanut butter cups went hand in hand with the rise of the industrialization of food. Makes sense.
Right.
But the guy who made it big was Mr. Reese.
Mr. Reese.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
He was someone who struggled a lot in his career and also had 16 children. So he kind of reached a breaking point.
Wow.
Yeah.
I've won and that's a struggle.
I know. I know.
Again, he probably didn't do all of the raising of his children by himself.
He did not. Absolutely
all
not.
With one woman?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. Who was legally blind.
What?
So I feel like they were just punishing themselves.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Her name was Blanche. She was probably a good woman.
Blanche was a rock star.
Yeah, exactly. Wow. So he at one point got a job at a dairy farm that the Hershey Corporation owned, which I guess Hershey tried every food product. And so for a while they were thinking about vertically integrating their own dairy farms. But then that shut down. But then he asked Mr. Hershey if he could like buy some chocolate in bulk and make his own candies. Because they were still in Hershey, Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. the Reese family. And he was like, go for it, kid, kind of thing. Because he was making them in his living room.
Wow. Mm-hmm. He's like, knock yourself out, see how far you get.
Exactly. Exactly. And then a salesman asked him to please make boxes of just the peanut butter cups because they were so many store owners were telling them that anecdotally most people like those best. And I guess Mr. Reese was like, gross. All right. But wow. Yeah, he like didn't buy it at all. But they started doing that and then they started selling them individually as penny candy. And there you go. Reese's just
exploded.
Yeah, absolutely.
Fascinating. Mm-hmm. And they're still to this day the most well-known peanut butter cup on the market.
They are. And again, they are owned. So after a while, after Mr. Reese died, his son sold the company back to Hershey for crazy amounts of money. They're all multi-millionaires.
Smart.
Yeah. Yeah. It is smart. But this is so weird to me. And it's funny how people let ego get in their way. So Mars had a peanut butter covered chocolate product for a while. It was called PB Max. And it didn't hit the market until something like the 80s. Mm-hmm. And it was because the Mars brothers who own Mars Corporation don't care for peanut butter. So anytime marketing would be like, you know, we should really have like a peanut butter candy. They were like, nah.
Interesting. Wait, was Mars, it was Abba Zaba, not Mars?
I have no idea.
Huh.
That'd Abba Zaba is like a peanut nougat-y?
It is. It's like a white nougat that's filled with peanut butter. Which I loved as a kid, but I haven't had one since I was probably 9, but I remember eating them as a kid and it's just like plain white nougat filled with peanut butter.
I do vaguely remember those.
I felt like that was made by Mars, but maybe I'm
well, no. They might have been. Yeah, they died since then because they had them on the market and then they were doing really, really well, like $50 million sales.
Mm.
And then the Mars brothers were like, nah. Take them off the market. Seriously. They're just like, it was because they don't personally like them.
But, yeah, I mean, I understand the feeling.
Yeah, completely. Michelle has looked up Abba Zaba bars and Annabelle Candy Company in Hayward, California. So maybe that's kind of a local treat.
Hmm.
Hayward is Northern California, but maybe they're like a West Coast creation. East Coasters who are listening, tell us if you were familiar with Abba Zaba.
I mean, I thought everyone was familiar with Abba Zaba. No, it's
well,
like
it's
that checkered.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. Now that I see it, I totally recognize it. But it is interesting how you can think that everyone knows something and then
right.
you find out that it's like from your town.
Then, right. And then you're like from Los Angeles and people are like, no, you're from LA. And
yeah, that is true too. We get everything
yeah.
in LA. We're lucky in that sense. Although peanut nougat, I'm like,
Interesting because I love candy with peanut butter, but I don't like Snickers because I feel like the peanuts get in the way.
Oh. Is there a Snickers knockoff that doesn't have peanuts in it?
I mean, there's Milky Way.
Milky Way.
Which is kind of the same thing without the peanuts.
Okay. So do you like Milky Way?
I like Milky Ways, but I only like dark chocolate Milky Ways.
Ooh.
There are very few candy bars that come in a dark chocolate option.
That's right.
And that's always what I would choose.
Yeah, I think I vaguely remember that. Dark chocolate gets a bad rap, but I think I like the bitterness of it.
I mean, I can't even eat milk chocolate anymore.
Really? Like it's disgusting to you?
I just have no desire. It's too sweet.
Okay.
That helps me out, like, around Halloween when mm-hmm. my son's trick-or-treating and I'm going through his bag. I literally will only... He hands me all of the things with dark chocolate. However, he loves dark chocolate, too. I think probably because the only chocolate we ever had in the house when he was a kid was dark.
Yeah.
And he loves chocolate. So...
How old is he now?
He just turned 9.
Oh, okay. He's still little. So that's amazing that his, like... fully formed taste buds that haven't been ground down by life yet. Like, yeah, can handle dark chocolate.
He will always choose dark chocolate over milk chocolate as well.
No.
That might be.
Two chef parents. Like, what a fancy little guy.
Or just what he's most familiar with. But he also won't eat peanut butter, so.
When Reese and his small staff first started, like, selling these peanut butter cups on a large scale, a selling point was that, like, each one was hand-dipped. And this was great. It was like artisanal, what we would call artisanal now.
For sure, not what you get today.
No. In fact, when Hershey started their marketing campaign in the 50s, they called them untouched by human hands.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, because that was something that people preferred.
Machine living.
Right.
Yeah.
Don't touch my food.
Exactly. Hmm. I think it's so interesting, and you can probably speak to this, how people are so afraid of germs and the idea of people touching their food, but I think that actually the more higher end the restaurant you go to, the more hands have been on your food.
Yeah, I mean, it's recently become health code standard to force employees to work with gloves, which I'm completely against. I actually find that there's a lot more cross-contamination from people who are using gloves than people who are using their bare hands. Because when cooks are wearing gloves, they often automatically feel like their hands are clean. So people will touch, say, a possible contaminant like raw chicken and then touch something else because they're wearing gloves. Their hands are clean. But unless you're changing your gloves or washing your gloves, which is also not as sanitary as washing your hands, then you're cross-contaminating even with gloves on. So I find that people are very naive when wearing gloves, and it tends to be more of a hazard than it is a safety precaution. So yeah, I go through boxes of gloves because people, you know, in our restaurants have to use them for butchery now, which I understand if you're handling chicken, or if you need to butcher something in the middle of service and you need to like run over and do something, absolutely wear gloves. Mm-hmm. Or if you're mixing raw meat with your hands, put on some gloves, but then throw them away immediately. Take them off, throw them away. I don't in any case feel like people should be working with gloves on.
Yeah, it's this, it makes me seem like such a gross California hippie, but it's so bad for the environment to be going through gloves like that. And it's unnecessary.
Totally unnecessary.
And I feel like the legislation was written by people who had like never been to a restaurant before.
Yeah.
Because they were like sushi chefs too. I was like, are you,
doesn't make
have
any
you
sense.
Ever eaten sushi? Like,
and are you taking off your gloves when you go from one piece of fish to the next? No. Why would you? You might wash your hands, but you're not taking off your gloves.
Yeah. It doesn't make any sense.
No.
So that is still currently the law. Gloves in
the
kitchen.
It depends on the circumstances.
Got it.
So there are ways around having to wear gloves all the time, and I will find those ways anywhere I can.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many arguments not to do it. Like, people who don't care about food can still care about the environment. It's just like, it's such a waste.
Absolutely.
Ugh, what a bummer. So, yeah, that comes from our, like, Puritan mid-century background. A lot of the people who are making legislation today were born in that era.
Mm-hmm.
In that totally terrified of germs era.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're back to a time where we're like, yeah, shove your kid's face in dirt. It's good for them.
Right? When my son was an infant and he'd drop his pacifier, I'd pick it up and suck the germs off for him and then give it back to him. I feel like, you know, sheltering kids from as many germs as possible just makes them sicker in the long run.
I think that's becoming the common wisdom again. And it's kind of related to allergies, because peanut allergies really strike fear in the hearts of parents, which I get.
It's interesting how that's such a common occurrence now to find people with peanut allergies, mm-hmm. whereas it was not. We didn't even think about it as kids. I can't send my son to school with a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. I can't send him with pirate's booty because of foodborne cheese allergies, dairy allergies. Yeah, I mean, it's insane what I can't send him to school with. And I believe that a lot of these allergies are incredibly valid. I'm not saying mm-hmm. people are faking their allergies. Mm-hmm. But I think that that has become more prevalent because of the fact that we keep kids away from so many things.
I think there's something to that because so for the past 15 years or so, it's been like, don't give kids peanuts until they're a year old. Mm-hmm. And the first time you give them peanuts, do it at the doctor's office,
right.
which is right. crazy.
So I mean, I was working a lot when my son was around one. Mm-hmm. We had just opened Hudson House and I had a sitter that was watching my son almost every night when he was little. And I remember coming home from work at like midnight and the jar of peanut butter was out on the counter. And my sitter was like, oh, I cut up an apple and put some peanut butter on it. And he took a bite. And I had this sort of like complete panic attack. Like, okay, apparently he's okay. This happened hours ago. Yeah. He's totally fine. But like, what? Everything that I'm told says to not give your kid peanut butter before the age of two mm-hmm. and do it at the doctor's office in case there's something that happens. I mean, I guess I got lucky. Nothing happened.
Yeah.
But my mom, I was talking to my mom. I told her the story and she was like, what are you talking about? Do it at the doctor's office. Are you insane? Then my niece actually became, or she, as an infant, was very allergic to nuts, but not peanuts, only tree nuts.
Oh, interesting.
So yeah, and one day miraculously her allergies completely vanished.
That is so weird.
So I mean, the doctor said he'd never seen it happen.
So I tried to find like the most recent article about peanut allergies in kids, and I guess today the common wisdom or conventional wisdom is like, you're fine to give your kids peanut products from the get-go as long as they don't have eczema. But if, because you know babies get weird right. skin stuff, if your baby yeah. has eczema, then you need to take all those precautions.
Interesting. They're related.
Related allergies. Okay. Somehow.
All right.
Yeah. Hmm. I don't know. Hmm. Just another thing to be terrified of as you raise your children, apparently. Too scary.
I don't know. My mom wasn't terrified of anything.
No, you're absolutely right. Because when we were like growing up, I remember, I think a lot about how I used to play in the woods all the time. Mm. That's not allowed anymore. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I tried not to, when I was pregnant, I tried not to listen to all the craziness that, because everyone has an opinion of what you should and shouldn't eat or drink. And you know, my doctor basically told me, have a drink now and again. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I wasn't drinking martinis. What I craved when it came to a cocktail when I was pregnant was Tecate and Clamato juice.
That's great, though, because that's like low alcohol.
Right? I was like, give me a beer cut with some tomato juice.
That's hilarious.
And I was a happy gal. It was like kind of warded off my nausea, and I was happy with that. And I had sushi on my birthday. So
love it.
You know, I'm sure you'll get a lot of comments about how horrible I was to my unborn child.
But you can just be like, here's a picture of him. Get lost.
He's fine.
Yeah.
He's
yeah.
fine.
No, that's great. And I do think that people are like unclenching a little bit when it
yes,
comes to pregnancy.
I agree. Yeah.
A little for a now. Little. We'll see.
Yeah.
Did you eat peanut butter cups while you were pregnant?
Yeah. Like by the dozens.
See?
Yeah.
Well, now, and you ruined his appetite for them.
Maybe he just got sick of tasting them in my stomach.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He'll probably be down for beer and another.
You know, it's funny. I didn't actually love chocolate until I got pregnant. I was always a sort of vanilla or fruit person.
Uh huh.
And I got pregnant and all I wanted was chocolate. And it stayed. It stuck.
That's so interesting how hormones can do that.
Right?
Do you think it changed your chef's palate as well? Did you start cooking differently?
So when, like, I don't know, right when I got pregnant, I started having a couple of food aversions. And one of those major aversions was garlic. I could not stand garlic.
Huh.
And at the time, we had this lamb bolognese. My husband and I had Beechwood at the time in mm-hmm. Venice. And I had a lamb bolognese on the menu that had a bunch of garlic in it. And I was the only one that knew how to make that bolognese. I would come in every day, and that's how I would start my day, is making that lamb bolognese. I was the first thing to come off the menu. And people would be like, what happened to the lamb bolognese? We loved the lamb bolognese. I was like, bleh. I couldn't even like say the words lamb bolognese. My husband comes from a very Italian family, mm-hmm. and we would go over to his grandmother would invite us over for dinner, and the whole house would smell like garlic, and she'd make like garlic bread. Pasta, tons of garlic, and she, you know, she understood that I just couldn't handle it at the moment, but at the same time, she's very Italian in the sense that she would, you know, constantly say, "You don't like my cooking? Is it my cooking that you don't like?"
Yeah.
But no, I think garlic was the biggest one for me, and the menu definitely. I learned how to make phenomenal tomato sauce without garlic in it. There are substitutes that can bring just as much flavor.
Okay. Yes. That's really funny. But now everything's back to normal.
Everything's back to normal.
Yeah.
Except I still love chocolate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And your peanut butter cups.
Yep.
Thank you so much for joining
Absolutely.
Us today.
Thank you. Thanks for all the history.
Oh, of course. My pleasure. In fact, do you want people to find you on Twitter and all that kind of stuff?
Sure. I'm at Chef Brooke W on everything. So Twitter and Instagram at Chef Brooke W. You can find me, and I'm relatively active.
Oh, nice.
Yes.
Very cool. And while you're at it, follow Smart Mouth on Facebook and Instagram. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. The waves keep on crashing on me for some reason. But your love keeps on coming like a thunderbolt. Well, come here a little closer, 'cause I wanna see you, baby, real close up. A Table Cakes production.